KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
In a parting move from the Biden administration, medical debt will soon be removed from credit reports.
But could the incoming Trump administration undo that?
Today is Tuesday, January 7th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. One day after Canada's prime minister announced plans to step down, President-elect Trump threatens Canada with economic pressure.
We don't need their cars. You know, they make 20% of our cars. We don't need that. I'd rather make them in Detroit. We don't need the cars. We don't need their lumber.
Also, new fiction takes on the subject of toxic motherhood.
This concept of the perfectly self-sacrificing mother for whom independent life ceased to exist.
And how tribal leaders are working to beat Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The rare event that is a presidential funeral has made its way to Washington, D.C., with the body of former President Jimmy Carter taken by horse-drawn caisson through snowy streets to the U.S. Capitol today. Members of the military escorted Carter's flag-draped casket to the Capitol Rotunda, where the 39th president will lie in state this week. Members of Congress, Supreme Court justices, and the public honoring Carter, including Senate Majority Leader John Thune.
Today I join all Americans in mourning President Carter and remembering his example. But I rejoice in the thought that he, together with his beloved wife, Rosalind, is now before the face of his father.
Carter's body left the Carter Presidential Center in Atlanta this morning, was flown to Washington aboard a special plane. Carter died at the age of 100 last month. A formal state funeral will be held Thursday at Washington National Cathedral. A New York appeals court denied President-elect Donald Trump's attempt to delay his criminal sentencing. More from NPR's Amanda Bastillo.
Trump is set to be sentenced for his hush money conviction in Manhattan on Friday, just 10 days before he's sworn in as president. The appeals court denied a request from Trump's lawyers to delay the date. A jury found Trump guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Trump is expected to attend the sentencing virtually, and the judge has already signaled that he is prepared to offer a rare, quote, unconditional discharge, meaning Trump will not face any prison time or any lesser fine or penalty. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, New York.
Facebook and Instagram owner Meta is getting rid of its fact-checking program, which has been accused of exercising anti-conservative bias. NPR's Shannon Bond reports the move is part of big changes the company's making in how it polices posts ahead of President-elect Donald Trump's second term.
Meta has relied on outside fact-checkers to address false and misleading posts since 2017. But CEO Mark Zuckerberg says the company has gone too far, echoing long-running complaints from President-elect Trump and other Republicans.
We've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship.
Meta will replace fact checks by independent professionals with community notes written by users, the same approach Elon Musk is taking at X. Some fact checkers who have worked with Meta for years pushed back against Zuckerberg's reference to, quote, censorship, saying they add context but have no power over Meta's content moderation decisions. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Mandatory evacuation orders are in place for more than 30,000 people living in Los Angeles County. That includes parts of the Pacific Palisades neighborhood and a section of the famed Pacific Coast Highway. Cal Fire officials have now widened their evacuation order, with a fire growing to more than 1,200 acres as 30-mile-an-hour winds continue to fan flames. On Wall Street today, stocks lost ground. The Dow was down 178 points. This is NPR. As the country heads toward a new administration in 2025, more Americans say that immigration should be a top focus for the U.S. government. President-elect Trump has promised the mass deportation of migrants and an end to birthright citizenship once he formally takes office. A poll done last month by the Associated Press Newark Center for Public Affairs Research finds about half of all U.S. adults named immigration and border topics in an open-ended question that asks them to share up to five issues they want government to work on. Every year, NPR's Student Podcast Challenge hands over the mic to students. To date, we've heard from more than 90,000 fourth graders, middle and high school students from all over the country. And now they're getting ready to do it again. Here's NPR's Janet Ujong Lee.
In her podcast, 14-year-old Lila Lanovich opens up about leaving school and losing social outlets to chronic illness. But Lila herself isn't the star of her story.
Introducing Lopez, the dog with a rainbow tail. Lopez loves balls, socks, and me. His job is to protect me and keep me safe, and he excels at it.
That's from Lopez the Rainbow-Tailed Service Dog, the middle school winner in NPR's 2024 Podcast Challenge. The contest provides an opportunity for young people like Lanovich to share their stories with our national audience. You have until May 2nd to submit your entry for the 2025 Student Podcast Challenge. You can find more information online. Good luck. Janet Wujongli, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices rose 69 cents a barrel to $74.25 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Medical debt will soon be wiped off the credit reports of millions of Americans. That is according to new rules announced today by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Healthcare debt burdens about 100 million people in this country, something that NPR has been reporting on in our Diagnosis Debt series with our partners at KFF Health News. And KFF's Noam Levy is here to talk about these new rules. Hi there.
Hi.
Noam, if you can, just start by laying out the problem. Why is this new policy necessary?
Well, so as many of your listeners no doubt know, medical debt is a huge problem. About 4 in 10 adults have some form of healthcare debt, we found. And it's taking a really grim toll on patients and their families. People are forced to work extra jobs, to drain their savings, even give up their homes, all because of big medical bills they can't pay. Now, one of the most pernicious ways that medical debt can hurt is by dragging down your credit score. You have an unpaid bill, it gets reported to a credit agency, and all of a sudden it's harder to get a car loan, to rent an apartment, get a job, or you have to pay a higher interest rate because you have bad credit. So that's part of the reason why a lot of patient and consumer advocates have pushed for these new rules, and it's why the Biden administration worked to expand protections for people with medical debt.
So tell us about this new policy. What exactly does it say, and when does it kick in?
So this reg was issued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's the watchdog agency that was set up after the 2009 financial crisis. And the agency began kind of digging into medical debt a few years ago, and it's been working on this regulation for a while. And it does kind of two important things. One, it bans credit agencies from including medical debt on consumers' credit reports. And it says that lenders can't consider medical information and debt as they assess borrowers. Now, it was just issued. It has to go to the Federal Register, and then it will be effective in 60 days, which works out to, I think, the middle of March, like March 17th.
I mean, just in a practical sense, what kind of impact do we think this will have on people's lives, given how many people are affected by medical debt in this country?
I mean, it could mean a lot, actually. Now, we should say that kind of as attention has focused on medical debt recently, the major credit bureaus have already started removing some medical debt from consumer reports. And this included smaller debts under $500. But millions of people around the country still have medical debt on their credit reports. And CFPB has estimated that about 15 million people who owe about $49 billion in medical debts could benefit from this. So that should boost people's scores, and it may make it easier to get a mortgage or rent a home.
Noam, here in Washington, in just a matter of days, there will be a new administration in power. Can the incoming Trump administration undo this?
Well, it's kind of a complicated question. Typically, when a new administration comes in, the president stops all federal agencies from issuing new rules, including ones that are under development. Trump did this the first time around in 2017, but This is now what's called the final rule. And that means that to undo it, the Trump administration would have to start a whole new rulemaking process, which typically takes months, even years, and it requires a lot of administrative hurdles. Now, if Trump and his GOP allies really want to scrap this, Congress could vote to rescind the regulation, but then a whole lot of Republicans would have to go on the record against what is probably going to be a pretty popular consumer protection. There is one more way, though, that Trump could hobble this. It seems pretty clear that the collections industry is going to sue to challenge this in court. And if that happens, typically the administration would defend the rule, but maybe Trump won't do that, and that would pretty much doom it.
Now, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is something that Elon Musk, a prominent Trump ally, has said that he wants to get rid of. Couldn't that mean a change to this policy?
Well, probably not. I mean, you're right. Musk has even posted on X that he wants to, quote unquote, delete the CFPB. And listeners may recall that Trump asked Musk to head up his government efficiency effort. But getting rid of a federal agency is not easy. And scrapping the CFPB entirely would probably need an act of Congress. And as you know, Republicans have a pretty thin majority on Capitol Hill. So that seems kind of unlikely at this point.
Noam Levy is a correspondent with our partner, KFF Health News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
No new banknote has entered the Gaza Strip in more than a year of war. As paper money falls apart, a new business has emerged. NPR's Daniel Estrin has the story with reporting from Gaza by NPR producer Anas Baba.
This shack in the courtyard of a shelter has a sign in big red Arabic letters. It advertises repairs for damaged cash. The repairman is Yasser Abu Erbaid. He lays a 20-shekel note, like a $5 bill, on a desk. It's got a tear. He cuts a piece of adhesive tape and tenderly tends to the torn tender. Cash repair is a vital service in Gaza. Cash repairman Abu Erbaid says, sometimes a single bill will change hands 10 times a day or more, and that leads to damage, wear, and tear. He operates a literal money laundering service, cleaning musty cash. He says, it seems the cash was stored or buried in the ground, possibly under the rubble of Israeli shelling, where it was exposed to moisture or rain. Was this cash taken from the rubble of a bank destroyed in Israeli strikes? Was it stored in damp underground Hamas tunnels? Israel says Hamas has looted banks. In this video, Israeli military spokesman Avichai Adrai presents what he says are Hamas documents detailing how its operatives stole more than $100 million worth of cash from banks. The Palestinian Authority in the Israeli-occupied West Bank won't send new cash to Gaza's banks as long as there's war, because of robberies and the risk, a Palestinian official tells NPR. He asked not to be named because he wasn't authorized to speak to the media. On top of that, many banks have been destroyed in Israeli strikes. Not a single bank or ATM is operating in Gaza today. So how do people get money? NPR producer Anas Baba stands outside a closed bank in central Gaza.
I can see that there are some people here. They came to the bank not looking for the ATM or the bank. They're looking for the brokers or the money mafia.
The money mafia, brokers with their own cash reserves. One man outside the bank looking for a broker is Musab Al-Shawaf. He says, we need to feed our children. The brokers are our last resort. Here's how it works. He transfers money from his bank account online to the broker's account, and the broker gives him cash, but takes a 30% commission. Shawaf says, the rate is very high. It's ruining me. Because of the cash crisis, Palestinian banks are offering e-wallets, digital currency. At this grocery store in central Gaza, a customer pays with his e-wallet, but paying that way comes with a 10 to 15% charge. Producer Anas Baba peruses the store.
Not everything that you need is here on the shelves. It's as usual, like lentils, beans.
It's hard to find food today. The United Nations says there's extreme hunger in Gaza. These days, there's a double struggle. The struggle to find basics like baby formula for a child, and the struggle to find the money to pay for it. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, with producer Anas Baba in Gaza.
Jean-Marie Le Pen, the founder of France's post-war far-right movement, died today. He was 96. He was repeatedly charged with hate speech by French courts and ran for president 5 times, never winning. His daughter is current far-right leader Marine Le Pen. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Jean-Marie Le Pen has been part of the French political landscape since he founded his far-right party in 1972. His fiery anti-immigrant rhetoric has inspired the European far-right today, says historian and political analyst Nicole Bacharan.
He is kind of the grandfather or the great-grandfather of the populist movement in Europe. He is the one who brought forward issues of immigration, globalization.
Le Pen was the only child of a religious mother and a fisherman father killed at sea by a German mine in 1942. After World War II, Le Pen worked his way through law school in Paris. As a young man in the 1950s, he joined the Foreign Legion and fought in France's colonial wars in Indochina and Algeria, fueled by a love of empire and a hatred of communists. Le Pen became one of the youngest members of the French Parliament in 1956. 16 years later, he founded his own party, the National Front. Its slogan, France for the French. For years, it was on the anti-immigrant nationalist fringe.
Je ne dis pas que les chambres à gaz n'ont...
A radio interview in the 80s sealed his fate. He suggested the Holocaust was a detail of history, and his political brand became, for many in France and Europe, toxic.
Le deuxième tour, celui...
But in 2002, to everyone's surprise, Le Pen made it to the second round of the French presidential election, a fluke due to a fragmented left-wing vote and poor turnout. The vote stunned the country. Millions demonstrated. Conservative candidate Jacques Chirac then crushed Le Pen with 82% of the vote in the second round, Bacharan.
And it was a huge shock.
His daughter, Marine Le Pen, took over the party in 2011, had a falling out with her father, and rebranded the movement. Unlike her father, she has a real chance of becoming president, says Bacharan.
She's the heir, definitely. She wouldn't be where she is if she wasn't his daughter.
Bacharan says Le Pen thrived on controversy for attention, but some of the ideas of the party he founded have gone mainstream in France and beyond. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back. Support for NPR comes from the station and from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In the opening pages of Emma Knight's debut novel, she describes a typical student breakfast at the University of Edinburgh, Scotland. Scrambled eggs too puffy to be true, she writes. Also, baked beans with a faint aftertaste of ash, pliable triangles of potato bread, and something darkly sausage-like. Well, I had to smile reading this, having been a student at a British university myself back in the 90s. Along with breakfast, Knight's novel takes on subjects of motherhood and female friendship and first love. The novel is The Life Cycle of the Common Octopus. Emma Knight, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a joy to be here.
And I have to congratulate you on the alarmingly accurate description of the darkly sausage-like food as you're describing the cafeteria offerings for students in Britain. Is this a delight you experienced firsthand?
It absolutely is, although my favorite was the porridge.
Which they do quite well.
Extremely well.
All right, so tell us about your protagonist. Her name is Pen, and she has just arrived as a student in Edinburgh.
Yes. So Pen is an overachieving 18-year-old late bloomer from Toronto. Her real name is Penelope, but she goes by the on-the-nose, on-purpose nickname Pen. She aspires to be a magazine writer, and she doesn't really believe in marriage, so she's cut off the elope.
I didn't even catch that as I was reading, but that's great. Yeah, go on.
So she, throughout her childhood, could sense that her parents were hiding something from her. And at age 18, she decides that she's going to find out what.
Yeah.
She goes to the University of Edinburgh in part to get far away from where she grew up and have adventures, but also because she wants to find an estranged friend of her father's.
This is a man named Lord Lennox.
Yeah.
And he is also an elusive Scottish writer of mysteries. Tell us more about him and his family, who we get to know quite well.
Yeah, so Elliot Lennox has been dubbed the peerless peer by the press. And he is a well-known author of detective fiction, whose series of novels have been gripping the world for over a decade by the time Penn tracks him down. And he is one of those fortunate people who found the right job for his talents. He grew up in a beautiful, crumbling castle on the east coast of Scotland, and he is extremely welcoming toward Penn, to a degree that surprises her. He invites her to spend the weekend. She writes him a letter through his literary agent, not even really expecting a response. And he writes back, inviting her to come on the train and spend the weekend. So she does, and she meets his seemingly perfect family, his captivating wife, Christina, and his son, Sasha.
Mm.
She keeps tugging at the thread of this family secret that she knows exists, but she doesn't know too much about it. And he does just about anything to make her feel welcome, except for answering her direct questions.
She does do a lot of growing up in that 1 year. You write one beautiful scene between her and her father, who has shown up out of nowhere. He decides he's going to appear and take her out to dinner. And you describe him, among other things, as knowing how to wield silence. And you write that Penn, in contrast, was too young still to know how not to fill the silence. Tell me what you're playing with there.
This is definitely something I'm still learning.
Yeah.
Part of it is about the sort of the dramatic irony that exists when one gets a bit older and is able to look back on one's younger self and see all of the knowledge gaps that are glaring. Penn the child is with her father, and Penn the adult is observing the questions that young Penn has for her father that he can't quite answer, the older narrator views with a lot more empathy and understanding of the position that he's in.
You also bring so much laughter and joy, just pure joy, to the scenes of what it's like to be 18 years old, 19 years old, out in the world for the first time. There's so much banter and silliness and flirting. That must have been a just total delight to write.
I had way too much fun writing The Reeling Ball.
Give us a taste of that one.
Well, there's a character called Fergus Scarletmore. He was actually the first character who came to me. He sort of strode into my brain wearing trousers the color of smoked trout and a melancholy frown and started heckling Penn. There's a lot happening at The Reeling Ball, but one of the things that's happening is a kind of mating dance between Fergus and Penn. The characters not knowing exactly what it is they want.
There's something Jane Austen about what you're describing there.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I love Jane Austen. I love Jane Austen. I mean, Evelyn Waugh writes funny college scenes very well, and young people thinking that they're sophisticated.
Yeah.
I mean, Jilly Cooper does such a great job of writing about the mating dance with a sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, and there's something so perfect and obvious, but writing about an actual dance as the mating dance is taking place in between the steps, it all comes together. Alert listeners may be wondering what on earth an octopus has to do with any of this. So explain your title, The Life Cycle of the Common Octopus.
So I don't want to give too much away, but I can say that the octopus in this novel is a metaphor for a kind of Loch Ness monster that I tortured myself with in early motherhood. And I don't think I'm the only one. This concept of the perfectly self-sacrificing mother for whom independent life and ambition cease to exist. Now, the octopus in real life is famous for spending a large portion of her life brooding over her eggs. So this creature works very hard to make it to adulthood in a difficult world, and then after mating, stops eating and begins to waste away while taking care of her eggs. And this beautiful brooding process is quite tragic. It is something that we as humans should not aspire to. Our children need us to be our authentic selves. They need us to continue living and to show them what it is to be a truthful person in this world.
I think you just ventured toward answering what was going to be my last question, which was the question that Penn poses to herself. Does a mother have to choose between being selfish and being eaten alive?
Oh, goodness. It's a daily question, isn't it?
Yeah.
No. A mother just has to carry on being herself.
That is Emma Knight, very much herself, talking about her debut novel, The Life Cycle of the Common Octopus. This was a delight. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary Louise.
This is NPR News.
Years ago, Jimmy Carter drew ferocious criticism.
As you know, I've been called an anti-Semite.
Because of a word he used about Israel, so we questioned him. Could you just make briefly the best case you can for why apartheid is the right word to use?
Well, I'll try to make a perfect case.
Our edgy conversation about the Middle East, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is the deadliest tick-borne disease in the U.S.
There's like this perfect storm that happens where you have a lot of free-roaming dogs, you have infected ticks, you have access to care that's limited.
So how are tribal communities in the Southwest working to beat it?
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The body of the nation's 39th president, Jimmy Carter, now lies in state at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the nation's longest-living former president died last week at the age of 100.
Members of the public will have the chance to pay their final respects to President Carter starting tonight. The former president will lie in state at the Capitol Rotunda until his funeral at the National Cathedral on Thursday. President Biden and President-elect Donald Trump are scheduled to attend, as are former presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. Afterward, Carter will be flown to his hometown of Plains, Georgia, for a private burial.
NPR's Windsor Johnston. Members of Congress also paid their respects earlier today to the former president. The Premier of Ontario, Canada, is dismissing comments by President-elect Donald Trump that Canada merged with the United States. As NPR's Jackie Northam tells us, Trump claimed on social media that many people in Canada love the idea of being part of the U.S.
For weeks, President-elect Trump has floated the idea of Canada becoming the 51st state and called Justin Trudeau a governor rather than prime minister. Shortly after Trudeau announced he's resigning, Ontario Premier Doug Ford told reporters he knows Trump likes making these kind of comments and joking around. But Ford says he takes it seriously and it would never happen under his watch. Ford also made a counteroffer to Trump.
How about if we buy Alaska and we'll throw in Minnesota and Minneapolis at the same time? So, you know, it's not realistic.
Ford later said he was joking about buying Alaska. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street after a pair of reports on the economy came in better than expected. The Dow down more than 170 points. This is NPR. NASA says it will hedge its bets and pursue two different options for an ambitious robotic mission to bring pristine rock samples back home from Mars. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more on the story.
The original plan had projected costs that had ballooned to around $11 billion. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson says it was unacceptable. He says instead the agency will simultaneously explore two cheaper options for getting Mars rocks home. One would use tried and true technology from past Mars missions. The other would rely on new commercial capabilities.
The final decision is likely to come in 2026.
He says either of these two options would cost around $6 to $7 billion and would get Mars rocks back before 2040. Scientists hope that studying these pristine rock samples could reveal whether Mars has ever been home to life in any form. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
Dock workers from East Coast and Gulf Coast ports are back at the bargaining table this week with shipping companies as a January 15th deadline approaches to come up with a new contract. The dock workers suspended their strike after a three-day walkout this fall. Both sides have agreed to a 62% pay raise over the next 6 years, but terms over shipyard automation still need to be worked out. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial,
helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President-elect Donald Trump doubled down today on his threat to impose steep tariffs on Canada. His warning comes a day after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced his plans to step down. Trump had previously belittled Trudeau and Canada, saying the country should give up its sovereign status and join the U.S. as another state.
In trade deficits, we're losing mass. We don't need their cars. You know, they make 20% of our cars. We don't need that. I'd rather make them in Detroit. We don't need the cars. We don't need their lumber.
So what does this mean for the future of trade relations between the U.S. and Canada? To answer that, we're joined now by NPR's Scott Horsley. He's here to help us dig a little bit deeper into the trade relationship between these two countries. Hey there.
I want to.
So, Scott, tell us just how important are the commercial ties between the U.S. and its northern neighbor?
They're pretty darn important. In fact, we just got some numbers from the Commerce Department this morning showing that in the first 11 months of last year, some $700 billion worth of stuff went back and forth between the U.S. and Canada. That is significantly more than we bought and sold with China. Gary Huffbauer, who's at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says for all the attention that trade with China gets, the strongest commercial ties are the ones closest to home.
The U.S. largest trading partner is now Mexico. But the second largest is Canada, and China's well below those two. So Canada's really important.
Scott, what are some of the biggest products moving back and forth across that border?
Well, the number one import to the U.S. from Canada is crude oil, which might surprise some people since the U.S. is also producing a record amount of crude oil itself right now. But, you know, the U.S. refines more oil than it produces, and Canada pumps more oil than it can refine. So Kevin Byrne, who's an energy analyst at S&P Global Commodity Insight, says this is a win-win relationship that's been good for both countries.
Canada is the U.S.'s largest source of foreign oil. It's north of 20% of U.S. refining runs. So it's a material share of what the U.S. requires to meet consumer demand every single day.
And some of those refined products are then sent back to Canada. There are similar close and reciprocal ties in the auto industry where parts go back and forth between Michigan and Ontario. This is a very integrated partnership that has grown up in the three decades since NAFTA, and imposing 25% tariffs like Trump has threatened to do would really throw a wrench into that.
But Scott, there are some trade frictions between the countries, right?
Oh, sure, always. I mean, U.S. dairy farmers complain that protectionist measures in Canada make it hard to sell milk and ice cream north of the border. U.S. sawmills complain about unfair subsidies on Canadian lumber. No drinking game about U.S.-Canada trade ties would be complete without a reference to softwood lumber. But economists say those are pretty small slices of what is actually a large and lucrative trading pie.
Now, Scott, we've heard some suggest that Trump's tariff talk, that it's just all a negotiating tactic. How likely is that?
Well, it could be. You know, we certainly saw examples of that during Trump's first term in office when he threatened more tariffs than he actually imposed. But this is a sensitive time, especially with the leadership vacuum in Ottawa that follows Justin Trudeau's announcement yesterday. Matthew Martin, who's at Oxford Economics, says if Trump were to make good on his tariff threats, there would not be any winners in the resulting all-out trade war.
The relative downside to Canada would be larger just because of how large a source of exports the U.S. is for them, but by no means would the U.S. go unscathed.
Not only would Americans have to pay more for Canadian imports, but Canada would almost certainly retaliate with taxes of its own on U.S. exports.
NPR Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
What will happen with the artificial intelligence industry under President-elect Trump? Well, many tech leaders want to know. Some of them are hoping that billionaire Elon Musk, serving as a close Trump advisor, will boost the AI sector. For more, we're joined by NPR's Bobby Allen. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So big picture, what you watching for in terms of what the Trump team might bring for AI companies?
Yeah, you know, from a very high level, it's expected to be a change in tone, right? The Biden administration took a somewhat antagonistic approach to AI with executive orders and rules aimed at beefing up safety measures. But Trump says he is finding AI advisors from within the AI and tech sector, people like David Sachs. He's a former PayPal executive and longtime venture capitalist. Trump is making him the White House's AI czar. That's someone who can set priorities for AI policy and help shape what federal rules could look like for AI. And Sriram Krishnan, he's another longtime venture capitalist who has invested in AI companies, and Trump is tapping him as an AI advisor. So these two top picks, Mary Louise, really show that the people who will be shaping AI policies are AI believers and individuals who have invested in AI companies. So Trump's AI policy, is going to be heavily influenced by industry types.
Okay, so fewer rules, fewer regulations. What might that actually look like in practice?
Well, Congress has never passed a piece of AI legislation, so there are no federal rules in the U.S. right now regulating the AI industry. But the Biden administration has exerted force in other ways. One key way has been through the Federal Trade Commission. It has opened investigations into nearly every big tech company. A lot of these companies are expected to be interested in purchasing smaller, very innovative AI companies in Trump's term. And the Biden administration has not been a fan of such mergers. They make larger companies even larger, but you know that could soon change. I talked to John Villasenor. He's a law and public policy professor at UCLA, and he says expect to see a lot more AI companies being gobbled up by the likes of Meta, Microsoft, and OpenAI.
There's going to be certainly a much greater willingness for larger established companies to make offers to buy up and coming AI startups. There's been a bit of a chill in the air under the Biden administration's FTC. So I think that'll likely be a lot less aggressively forced under the Trump administration.
And, you know, critics of consolidation in the tech industry say it can lead to less competition so that the quality of products could potentially get worse over time and prices for consumers could go up.
Bobby, go back to Elon Musk, who, as we know, is playing an outsized role in Trump's transition. Do we know if he's likely to play an outsized role in AI policy once they actually get to the White House?
Yeah. Well, on top of heavy hitter companies that he runs like Tesla and SpaceX, Musk has his own AI company called xAI. So he does have a vested interest in policies that could spur more growth for the AI industry. And he wants federal policies to advance the development of autonomous vehicles. And Tesla could have a large role in that. And, you know, Musk has talked about the need to onshore the production of semiconductor chips used to power AI systems.
To onshore them, so meaning making them in the U.S. as opposed to Taiwan, where they're mostly made now?
That's exactly right. 90% of the most advanced ones are made there. And now there is bipartisan support for more chip production in the U.S. That was the whole push of the CHIPS Act, which Congress passed. It pumped billions into making the U.S. more competitive globally in the chip sector. But a lot has to be done in order to go toe-to-toe with Taiwan, and AI is just highly, highly dependent, Mary Louise, on these cutting-edge chips that the Trump administration, soon to be at least, is hoping to make more of in the U.S.
NPR's Bobby Allen. Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Australia, there's a little critter known as the marsupial mole. It has lush golden fur, it is blind, it has flipper-like front feet so it can swim through desert sands, and it is not easy to find. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on how scientists recently learned some of its secrets.
There's moles around the world, but the moles of Australia are special because they're marsupials.
Their body plan and limbs and stuff look just like the European mole or the star-nosed mole, but they're completely unrelated.
Nathan Clark is a biologist with the University of Pittsburgh. His lab has been studying how different moles have adapted to living completely underground.
That's clearly a very extreme change to go deep underground, dark, different foods, different air, everything is so drastic.
A fully subterranean life does have advantages, like protection from predators and extreme temperatures. So within mammals, this lifestyle has evolved independently at least five times. He was really curious about how this happened in Australia, a continent where the northern and southern marsupial moles have been isolated for millions of years. These little marsupials have pouches, like kangaroos, but the mole's pouch is upside down.
Its pouch did a 180 at one point. Who knows how that happened?
Presumably, it's so the pouch won't fill with sand as the mole swims forward. These moles are so obscure, a mere sighting makes headlines. Clark says they're difficult to study.
It's endangered, so you're not allowed to go looking for it. It's extremely rare anyways, and it's in Australia in the desert. And how are you going to find this thing? It doesn't have permanent tunnels.
Still, Clark and some other colleagues recently teamed up with biologists in Australia. They took genetic samples from a single museum specimen, a dead female southern marsupial mole. It turns out the mole's closest relatives are two small nocturnal marsupials, the bandicoot and the bilby. What's more, genetic evidence suggests that the marsupial mole's population may have suffered an abrupt crash around 70,000 years ago, possibly related to climate change.
I think that's definitely one of the major findings of this paper.
Sarah Lucas is currently with the University of Munster in Germany and a member of the research team. It's just published its analysis in the journal Science Advances.
They were listed as extremely endangered because we had no idea about what their population dynamics were happening. And again, it's really hard to find a living one.
She says another key finding is how the marsupial mole gradually went blind as vision-related genes degraded. First to go were genes related to the eye's lens, then genes for cone cells that perceive bright light, then genes for rod cells used in dim light. This progression was striking and made the researchers wonder if other mammals that have lost vision follow a similar sequence of events.
We're trying to actually study more on how other mammals lose their eyesight to see how unique or not the marsupial mole is compared to them.
Like bats, for example, they also come to rely less on vision, even though they live in the darkness of the night air instead of the blackness underground. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is the deadliest tick-borne disease in the U.S. It's been a persistent problem on some tribal lands in the Southwest where residents are at particular risk. But the community has made progress in preventing deaths from the disease. NPR's Ping Huang went to tribal lands in rural Arizona to see how they did it.
It's golden hour at a cattle ranch on the San Carlos Apache Reservation. The sun is low and the animals have settled in their pen. In Houston, Ty Hinton, resident stockman, is coming down after a long day of branding cattle. He sits on a bale of hay, spurs dangling, to talk about a recent illness. First, he's clear. He is not one to go to the doctor.
Cowboying, you always get hurt a lot, you know, so I do go to the hospital, but not regularly. I broke my collarbone one time and broke it in half and just let it heal on its own. That's just the way I was raised, you know?
He chases bulls on horseback and lassos them for work. But back in November, it was a different kind of job hazard that got him. It started with his stomach. He felt nauseous, like he needed to throw up all the time, and it wouldn't go away. On top of that, he started getting bad headaches and a fever.
It was a couple days that I'd had the fever, and then, you know, about the third day, and it didn't subside, I was like, you know, something's got to be seriously wrong with me.
With urging from his wife, Hinton dragged himself to the reservation's tribal health center, where he got diagnosed with Rocky Mountain spotted fever. The disease was first identified in the late 1800s in the Rocky Mountains of western Montana, though it's found all over the country now. In more recent times, it's become a scourge on some Native American lands in the Southwest. In the past 20 years, there's been more than 500 cases and 25 deaths on tribal lands in Arizona. Residents on the hardest-hit reservations have been more than 150 times more likely to catch it than in the rest of the country. Hinton didn't see the tick that bit him, but he developed the signature rash.
I did find a spot on my foot. That there was a rash that had started there and I just didn't notice it, you know.
When an infected tick bites someone, it transmits bacteria called Rickettsia rickettsii. Johanna Salzer is a top expert on Rocky Mountain spotted fever at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She says the bacteria attack the lining of the blood vessels.
You think about spotted fever because it can cause a rash when people become severely ill. It's all of the busting of those blood vessels as the organisms are coming out.
From the outside, it looks red and splotchy.
The rash you see on a person's exterior is also happening throughout their body. So it's a multi-system organ failure that happens.
Antibiotics are an effective treatment, but only if they're used quickly. People can die within 8 days of getting symptoms. Rocky Mountain spotted fever first showed up in these parts back in 2003 with the sudden death of a child on a nearby reservation. Soon, more cases came. This was puzzling to doctors because in most of the country, the disease tends to come from ticks in the forest. Here in the dry desert, among the saguaro cactuses and tumbleweeds, investigators found a different species as the culprit, the brown dog tick. Maureen Brophy is an entomologist with CDC. She and Salzer are here on the reservation going house to house with the tribal health department. They're suited up in field clothes, long sleeves and long pants covered in tick repellent, and they're here to help with disease prevention.
Right, so yeah. I'm going to set my traps in the usual spots.
Yeah.
For Brophy, that means crawling under the porch to trap some ticks.
The dry ice emits carbon dioxide, and when the ticks sense carbon dioxide in the environment, they are attracted to it, they'll start crawling towards it.
Brophy points out gaps between the porch slats where ticks like to hide. She also points out patches of tall grass and old furniture in the yard, places where dogs and children might pick up ticks. And while high season is typically in the spring and summer, Brophy says here, the ticks bite year-round.
And so here, and in the areas where brown dog ticks are transmitting, there's like this perfect storm that happens where you have a lot of free-roaming dogs, you have infected ticks, you have access to care that's limited either, you know, by finances or geography or whatever.
So the tribe sees prevention as a year-round effort too. They tackle ticks by spraying pesticides around people's homes.
I'm gonna get this one a new collar. You don't have a collar.
And providing tick collars for dogs when they can, though the collars are expensive and there aren't enough to go around. Because the way that Rocky Mountain spotted fever spreads here is tied up with the many dogs that live on the reservation. Each household, on average, has three or four dogs, and then there are the stray dogs that roam the reservation. As we drove through town, we saw bumper stickers that say, "I break for res dogs." We tracked down the designer, Nolan Pike, by phone.
I care, and there's a lot of community members that care for these stray dogs on our reservation.
But Pike, like many others, knows that there are thousands of dogs roaming freely between the desert landscape and people's homes that serve as a superhighway for ticks.
I know that there's always kind of a line, and that line is not to really let them near your home or near your babies. Because of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and at times we do get cases, and we've lost community members to it.
In the past, tribal elders had resisted efforts to control the stray dogs, but those attitudes are changing. For 5 years now, nobody has died from Rocky Mountain spotted fever on this reservation or the ones around it, but no deaths doesn't mean no cases. Hardy Bendel, head of animal control on the reservation, has been working to protect his tribe from Rocky Mountain spotted fever for over a decade. He meets us in a neighborhood he's been keeping a close eye on.
This area has been one of our target areas. Most of the cases that we see come from here.
Bendel is on the front lines dealing with dogs and ticks all the time. Most days, it's just him and his two-person field team holding the line across all 1.8 million acres of the reservation.
The difference I've seen in the past 12, 13 years I've been here, this time of year, you'd see dogs packed with ticks in their ears and under their bellies and whatnot, you know.
Today, the dogs in this neighborhood have tick collars and there are no ticks to be found. But Bendel knows the problem needs constant tending, even in the dead of winter, because the only way to prevent people in his community from dying of Rocky Mountain spotted fever is to stop them from getting bitten by ticks. Ping Huang, NPR News, San Carlos Apache Indian Reservation.
And that piece was produced by Megan Lim.
Among many other things, the late President Jimmy Carter was also a huge movie buff, and in his home state of Georgia, he is remembered as a big supporter of the film industry. That story is tomorrow on Morning Edition. If you are not by your radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12, mathnasium.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com. Not available in California.
What you sow, honey.